This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents At the Water's Edge by Sarah Gruen. Read for you by Justine Eyre. One crow for sorrow, two crows for mirth, three crows for a wedding, four crows for a birth, five crows for silver, six crows for gold, seven for a secret, never to be told. Prologue. Drumna Drocket, February 28, 1942. Agnes Marie Grant, infant daughter of Angus and Marie Grant, January 14, 1942. Captain Angus Duncan Grant, beloved husband of Marie, April 2, 1909 to January 1942. The headstone was modest and hewn of black granite, granite being one of the few things never in short supply in Glenurquhart, even during the present difficulty. Marie visited the tiny swell of earth that covered her daughter's coffin every day, watching as it flattened. Archie the stonecutter had said it might be months before they could put up the stone with the frost so hard upon them, but the coffin was so small the leveling was accomplished in just a few weeks. No sooner was the stone up than Marie got the telegram about Angus, and had Archie take it away again. Archie had wanted to wait until the date of death was verified, but Marie needed it done then, to have a place to mourn them both at once, and Archie could not say no. He chiseled Angus's name beneath his daughter's, and left some room to add the day of the month when they learned it. An addition for an absence, because Angus, unlike the wee bairn, was not beneath it, and almost certainly never would be. There were just the two of them in the churchyard when Archie returned the headstone. He was a strong man, heaving a piece of granite around like that. A shadow flashed over her, and she looked up. A single crow circled high above the graves, never seeming to move its wings. One crow for sorrow. It was joined by another, and then two more. Two crows for mirth, three crows for a wedding, four crows for a birth. Archie removed his hat and twisted it in his hands.
If there is anything more I can do, anything at all.
Marie tried to smile and succeeded only in producing a half-choked sob. She pulled a handkerchief from her pocket and pressed it to her mouth. Archie paused as though he wanted to say more. Eventually he replaced his hat and said,
Well then, I'll be off.
He nodded firmly and trudged back to his van. It was Willie the postie who had delivered the telegram, on Valentine's Day no less, a month to the day after the birth. Marie had been pulling a pint behind the bar when Anna came, ashen-faced, whispering that Willie was on the doorstep and would not come inside. Willie was a regular, so Marie knew from that very moment, before she even approached the door and saw his face. His hooded eyes stared into hers, and then drifted down to the envelope in his hands. He turned it a couple of times, as though wondering whether to give it to her, whether not giving it to her would make the thing it contained not true. The wind caught it a couple of times, flicking it this way and that. When he finally handed it to her, he offered it up as gently as a new-hatched chick. She opened it, turned it right side up, and let her eyes scan the purple date stamp, February 14th, 1942, added by Willie himself not half an hour before, and then... Mrs. Marie Grant, 6 High Road Drum, Invernessshire. Deeply regret to inform that your husband, Captain Angus D. Grant, Seaforth Highlanders, 4th Battalion, 179994, is missing, presumed killed on war service, January 1st, 1942. Letter with details to follow. She took in only three things. Angus, killed, the date, and they were enough.
I'm sorry, Marie, Willie said in a near whisper. Especially so soon after...
His voice trailed off. He blinked, and his eyes drifted down, pausing briefly on her belly, before coming to rest again on his hands. She could not reply. She closed the door quietly, walked past the hushed locals, and into the kitchen. There she leaned against the wall, clutching her empty womb with one hand, and the piece of paper that had brought Angus's death in the other. for it did seem as though it was the paper that brought his death, rather than simply the news of it. He had been dead for more than 6 weeks, and she hadn't known. In the time between the arrival of the telegram and the return of the headstone with Angus's name on it, Mari had begun to blame Willie. Why had he chosen to hand her the telegram? She had seen his hesitation. He would have been complicit in what, at worst, would have been a lie of omission, especially if it meant she could believe that Angus was still out there, somewhere. Even if he was doing things she couldn't comprehend, things that might change him, in the terrible ways the men who had already been sent home had been changed, she could believe he was alive and therefore fixable, for surely there was nothing she couldn't love him through once he came home. They had lied to her about the baby, and she had let them. Since she had first felt the baby quicken, she was keenly aware of its every movement. For months, she had watched in wonderment as little brays poked up from her belly, pushing their way across, an elbow, or perhaps a knee, a subterranean force that constantly rearranged the landscape of her flesh. Was it a boy, or a wee girl? Whichever it was, it already had strong opinions. She remembered the moment it occurred to her that it had been hours since she felt it move, an Hogmanay, of all days. At midnight, precisely when Ian McIntosh struck in his pipes to form the first chord of Auld Lang Syne, and seconds before corresponding shots rang out from the doorway of Donnie McLean, Mari began poking her belly, trying to wake it, for they said that unborn babes slept. She yelled at it, screamed at it, and finally, realizing, wrapped her arms around it and wept. 13 days later, her pain started. Her memories of the birth were vague, for the midwife had given her bitter tea mixed with white powder, and the doctor held ether over her nose and mouth at regular intervals, putting her under completely at the end. They told her the baby had lived a few minutes, long enough to be baptized. Their lie became her lie, and that was what went on the headstone. In truth, she'd probably lost both child and husband on the same date. The promised letter never arrived. Where had he died? How had he died? Without the dreaded details, she had only her imagination, her terrible imagination. And while she wished she couldn't fathom what his last moments might have been, she could, with distinct and agonizing precision, in a million different ways. Please God that they were moments indeed, and not hours or days. The murder of crows descended in a noisy fluster, settling in a row on the stone wall, huddling into themselves, their blue-black feathers puffed and their heads tucked in, as though they'd pulled up their coat collars. They stared accusingly, miserably, but without their usual commentary. Mari counted them twice. 7 for a secret, never to be told. She knew then that she would never know the details, would never know what had happened. A bone-chilling wind stirred the fallen leaves until they formed cyclones that danced among the graves. Mari crouched and fingered the names of her child and husband in the black stone. Agnes. Angus. A third of the stone was still blank at the bottom. There was room for one more name, one more set of dates, and these would be accurate. She stood without taking her eyes off the stone. She wiped her eyes and nose on the handkerchief and kept it in her hand as she wrapped her arms around herself and walked through the black iron gate, leaving it swinging. She headed toward the inn, except when she got to the crossroad, she turned left instead of going straight. A light snow began to fall, but despite her bare head and legs, she trudged right past the Farquhar's croft. She'd have been welcome there, as well as at the Mackenzies, where she could see the fire glowing orange through the window. But on she went, teeth chattering, hands and shins numb. Eventually the castle rose on her left, its majestic and ruined battlements like so many broken teeth against the leaden sky. She had played within its walls as a child, and knew which rooms remained whole, where you had to watch your footing, where the best hiding places were, where the courting couples went. She and Angus had been among them. The snow was heavier now, falling in clumps, that collected and melted on her hair. Her ears were past stinging. She pulled her sleeves over her frozen hands and pinched them shut with her fingertips. Through the gatehouse, past the kiln, pushing through the long grass and scrub gorse, bracken and thistles, straight to the water gate. She paused at the top, staring at the blackness of the lock. Thousands of tiny white caps danced on its surface, seeming to move in the opposite direction of the water beneath them. It was said that the lock contained more water than all the other bodies of water, not just in Scotland, but also in England and Wales combined, and it held other things as well. She had been warned away from it her entire life, for its depth came quickly, its coldness was fierce, and the kelpie lay in wait. She picked her way sideways down the slope, letting her icy fingers out of her sleeves to hold up the hem of her coat. When she reached the bottom, the water lapped around the soles of her shoes. The edge of the lock looked seductively shallow, slipping over the gravel and back into itself. She took a step forward, gasping as the water flooded her shoes. So cold, so cold. And yet it had never frozen, not once in recorded history. Another step, another gasp. Bits of peat swirled in the water around her ankles, circling her legs, beckoning her forth. Another step, and this time she stumbled, finding herself knee-deep. Her wool coat floated, an absurd umbrella, first resisting and finally wicking water, pulling her deeper. She looked back at the landing, suddenly desperate. If only she had a hat, she could throw it back onto the thorny gorse. If she'd had anything that would float, maybe they'd think it was an accident and let her be buried with her daughter. Maybe they'd think the kelpie took her. And then she remembered that the lock never gave up its dead, so she spread her arms wide and embraced it. Chapter 1. Scottish Highlands, January 14th, 1945.
"Oh, God, make him pull over," I said, as the car slung around yet another curve in almost total darkness.
It had been nearly 4 hours since we'd left the naval base at Altbay, and we'd been careening from checkpoint to checkpoint since. I truly believe those were the only times the driver used the brakes. At the last checkpoint, I was copiously sick, narrowly missing the guard's boots. He didn't even bother checking our papers, just lifted the red and white pole and waved us on with a look of disgust.
"Driver, pull over," said Alice,
who was sitting in the back seat between Hank and me.
"I'm afraid there is no offer,"
the driver said, in a thick Highland accent, his R's rolling magnificently. He came to a stop in the middle of the road. It was true. If I stepped outside the car, I would be ankle-deep in thorny vegetation and mud, not that it would have done any more to destroy my clothes and shoes. From head to toe, I was steeped in sulfur and cordite and the stench of fear. My stockings were mere cobwebs stretched around my legs, and my scarlet nails were broken and peeling. I hadn't had my hair done since the day before we'd sailed from the shipyard in Philadelphia. I had never been in such a state. I leaned out the open door and gagged while Alice rubbed my back. Wet snow collected on the top of my head. I sat up again and pulled the door shut.
"I'm sorry. I'm finished. Do you think you can take those things off the headlights? I think it would be better if I could see what's coming."
I was referring to the slotted metal plates our one-eyed driver had clipped on before we'd left the base. They limited visibility to about 3 feet ahead of us.
"Can't,"
he called back cheerfully.
"It's a blackout."
As he cranked up through the gears, my head lurched back and forth. I leaned over and cradled my face in my hands. Alice patted my shoulder.
"We should be nearly there. Do you think fresh air would help?"
I sat up and let my head flop against the back of the torn leather seat. Alice reached across and rolled the window down a crack. I turned toward the cold air and closed my eyes.
"Hank, can you please put out your cigarette?"
He didn't answer, but a whoosh of frigid air let me know he had tossed it out the window.
"Thank you," I said weakly.
20 minutes later, when the car finally came to a stop and the driver cut the engine, I was so desperate for solid ground, I spilled out before the driver could get his own door open, never mind mine. I landed on my knees.
"Maddie,"
Alice said in alarm.
"I'm all right," I said.
There was a fast-moving cloud cover under a nearly full moon, and by its light, I first laid eyes on our unlikely destination. I climbed to my feet and reeled away from the car, thinking I might be sick again. My legs propelled me toward the building, spinning ever faster. I crashed into the wall, then slid down until I was crouching against it. In the distance, a sheep bleated. To say that I wished I wasn't there would be a ludicrous understatement, but I'd only ever had the illusion of choice.
"We have to do this," Hank had said. "It's for Alice."
To refuse would have been tantamount to betrayal, an act of calculated cruelty. And so, because of my husband's war with his father, and their insane obsession with a mythical monster, we'd crossed the Atlantic at the very same time a real madman, a real monster, was attempting to take over the world for his own reasons of ego and pride. I would have given anything to go back 2 weeks to the beginning of the New Year's Eve party and script the whole thing differently. Chapter 2. Rittenhouse Square, Philadelphia, December 31st, 1944.
5, 4, 3, 2...
The word one had already formed on our lips, but before I could slide off, there was an explosion overhead. As screams rose around us, I pitched myself against Ellis, tossing champagne over both of us. He threw an arm protectively around my head and didn't spill a drop. When the screams petered out, I heard a tinkling above us, like glass breaking, along with an ominous groaning. I peeked out from my position against Ellis's chest.
"What the hell?" said Hank, without a hint of surprise.
I think he was the only person in the room who hadn't jumped. All eyes turned upward. 30 feet above us, a massive chandelier swung on its silver-plated chain, throwing shimmering prisms across the walls and floor. It was as if a rainbow had burst into a million pieces, which were now dancing across the marble, silks, and damask. We watched, transfixed. I glanced nervously at Alice's face, and then back at the ceiling. An enormous cork landed next to General Pugh, our host at what was easily the most anticipated party of the year, bouncing outrageously like a bloated mushroom. A split second later, a single crystal, the size of a quail's egg, fell from the sky and dropped smack into his cocktail, all but emptying it. He stared, bemused and tipsy, then calmly took out his handkerchief and dabbed his jacket. As everyone burst into laughter, I noticed a footman in old-fashioned knee-breeches, perched near the top of a stepladder, pallid, motionless, struggling to contain the biggest bottle of champagne I'd ever seen. On the marble table in front of him was a structure of glasses, arranged so that if someone poured continuously into the top one, they would eventually all be filled. As a rush of bubbles cascaded over the sides of the bottle and into the footman's sleeves, he stared in white-faced horror at Mrs. Pugh. Hank assessed the situation and apparently took pity on the fellow. He raised his glass, as well as his other hand, and with the flare and flourish of a ringmaster boomed,
"One! Happy New Year!"
The orchestra struck up Auld Lang Syne. General Pugh conducted with his empty glass, and Mrs. Pugh beamed at his side. Not only was her party a smashing success, but it now had a comic anecdote people would speak of for years. Should old acquaintance be forgot and never brought to mind? Should old acquaintance be forgot and Auld Lang Syne? Those who knew the words sang along. I had refreshed my memory that afternoon in order to be ready for the big moment, but when cork met crystal, the lyrics were knocked straight out of my brain. By the time we got to running about slopes and picking daisies fine, I gave up and joined Ellis and Hank in la-la-laing our way through the rest. They waved their glasses in solidarity with General Pugh, their free arms looped around my waist. At the end, Ellis leaned in to kiss me. Hank looked to one side, then the other, and appeared baffled.
I seem to have misplaced my date. What have I done with her?
What you haven't done is marry her, I said, and then snorted, nearly expelling champagne through my nose. I had sipped my way through at least 4 glasses on an empty stomach, and was feeling bold. His mouth opened in mock offense, but even he couldn't pretend ignorance about Violet's growing desperation at the seemingly endless nature of their courtship.
"Did she actually leave?" he said, scanning the room a little more seriously.
"I'm not sure," I said. "I haven't seen her in a while."
"Then who'll give me my New Year's kiss?" he asked, looking bereft.
"Oh, come here, you big lug." I stood on tiptoe and planted a kiss on his cheek. You've always got us, and we don't even require a ring. Alice threw us an amused side eye and motioned to Hank that he should wipe my lipstick off his cheek. Beyond him, the footman was still balanced on the second to highest rung of the stepladder. He was bent at the waist, trying to aim the bottle at the top glass, and had gone from pale to purple with the effort. His mouth was pressed into a grim line. I looked around to see if reinforcements were coming and didn't see any. "Alice, I think he needs help," I said, tilting my head in the footman's direction. Alice glanced over.
"You're right," he said, handing me his glass. "Hank, shall we?" "Do you really think she's left?" Hank said wistfully, his lips hovering near the edge of his glass. "She was a vision tonight. That dress was the color of the gloaming, the sequins, jealous stars in the galaxy of her night, but nothing, nothing could compare to the milky skin of her."
"Boys, concentrate," I said. Hank snapped back to life.
"What?" "Maddie thinks that man needs help," said Alice.
"That thing's enormous," I said. "I don't think he can hold it on his own."
"I should think not. That's a Balthazar," said Alice.
"That's not a Balthazar," Hank said. "That's a Nebuchadnezzar." The footman's arms were quaking. He began pouring, but missed. Champagne fell between the glasses, splashing onto the table and floor. His gloves and sleeves were saturated.
"Uh-oh," said Hank. "Uh-oh, indeed," said Alice. "Mrs. Pugh will not be pleased." "I rather suspect Mrs. Pugh is never pleased," Hank said.
Rivulets of sweat ran down the footman's forehead. It was plain to see that he was going to fall forward, right onto the glasses. I looked to Mrs. Pugh for help, but she had disappeared. I tried to signal the general, but he was holding court with a replenished cocktail. I dug my elbow into Alice's side. "Go," I said urgently. "Go help him."
"Who's she talking about?" said Hank.
I glared at him, and then some more, until he remembered.
"Oh, of course."
He tried to hand me his glass, but I was already holding two. He set his on the floor and yanked his lapels in a businesslike manner. But before he and Alice could mobilize, help arrived in the form of other servants, bearing four smaller, but still very large bottles, and three more stepladders. Mrs. Pugh glided in behind them to make sure all was under control.
"Now those are Balthazars," said Hank, with a knowing nod.
He retrieved his drink from the floor and drained it.
"No, those are Jeroboams," said Alice. "I think I know my champagne," said Hank. "And I don't."
"I think you're both wrong. Those are Ebenezers," I said. That stopped them. I broke into tipsy giggles. "Ebenezer? Get it? Christmas? The holidays? Oh, never mind. Someone get me another. I spilled mine."
"Yes, on me," said Alice.
Hank spun around and set his glass on the tray of a passing waiter. He clapped his hands.
"All right, who's up for a snowball fight?"
We toppled outside and made snow angels right there in front of the Pugh's home and all the cars and liveried drivers that were lined up waiting for guests. I gathered one snowball and managed to land it on Alice's chest before screeching and running back inside. In the vast foyer, Alice helped brush the snow off my back and hair. Hank hung his jacket over my bare shoulders, and the two of them guided me to a trio of ornate, embroidered chairs near a roaring fire. Hank, who had had the presence of mind to grab my mink stole on the way back in, shook it off and draped it over the edge of the rosewood table in front of us. Alice went in search of hot toddies, and I peeled off my gloves, which were stained and soaked. "God, look at me," I said, gazing down at myself. "I'm a mess." My silk dress and shoes were ruined. I tried in vain to smooth out the water spots and checked quickly to make sure I still had both earrings. The gloves were of no consequence, but I hoped the stole could be saved. If not, I'd succeeded in destroying my entire outfit.
"You're not a mess. You're magnificent," said Hank.
"Well, I was," I lamented. I'd spent the afternoon at Salon Antoine having my hair and makeup done, and had eaten almost nothing for 2 days before so my dress would drape properly. It was a beautiful pomegranate red silk, the same material as my shoes. It matched my ruby engagement ring, and all of it set off my green eyes. Alice had given me the dress and shoes a few days earlier, And before the party, I had presented myself to him like a flamenco dancer, twirling so the skirt would take flight. He professed his delight, but I felt a familiar pang of sorrow as I tried, yet again, to imagine exactly what he was seeing. My husband was profoundly colorblind, so to him, my ensemble must have been a combination of grays. I wondered which ones, and how many variations there were, and whether they had different depths. I couldn't imagine a world without color. Hank dropped into a chair, leaving one leg dangling over its arm. He pulled his bow tie open and undid his cuffs and collar. He looked like a half-drowned Clark Gable. I shivered into his jacket, holding it closed from the inside. Hank patted his chest and sides. He stopped suddenly and lifted an eyebrow. "Oh," I said, realizing what he was looking for. I retrieved the cigarette case from his inside pocket and handed it to him. He flipped it open and held it out, in offering. I shook my head. He took a cigarette for himself and snapped the case shut.
"So, how about it, then?" he said, his eyes glistening playfully. "Shall we go get us a monster?"
"Sure," I said, waving my hand. "We'll hop on the next liner." It was what I always said when the topic came up, which was often and always after boatloads of booze. It was our little game.
"I think getting away would do Ellis good. He seems depressed."
"Ellis isn't depressed," I said. "You just want to escape Violet's clutches."
"I do not," he protested.
"You didn't even notice when she left tonight." Hank cocked his head and nodded, conceding the point.
"I suppose I should send flowers."
"First thing in the morning," I said. He nodded.
"Absolutely. At the crack of noon. Scout's honor."
"And I think you should marry her. You need civilizing, and I need a female friend. I have only you and Alice." He clutched a hand to his heart, mortally wounded.
"What are we, chopped liver?"
"Only the finest foie gras. Seriously, though, how long are you going to make her wait?"
"I'm not sure. I don't know if I'm ready to be civilized yet. But when I am, Violet can have the honors. She can pick a mean set of china."
As I set my drink down, I caught another glimpse of my dress and shoes. "I think maybe I need civilizing. Will you just marry her already?"
"What is this, an ambush?"
He tapped the cigarette against the top of the case and put it between his lips. A servant appeared from nowhere to light it.
Thanks, Hank said, inhaling.
He leaned back and let smoke drift from his mouth to his nose in a swirling white ribbon that he re-inhaled. He called this maneuver the Irish waterfall.
"If I do marry her, Ellis and I won't have a hope because you girls will gang up on us."
"We won't be able to," I said. "The distribution will be equal."
"They are never equal between the sexes. You already gang up on Ellis and me all by yourself."
"I do not."
"You're ganging up on me right now at this very minute, single-handedly baiting the marriage trap. I tell you, it's the ultimate female conspiracy. You're all in on it. Personally, I can't see what all the fuss is about."
Alice returned, followed by a waiter who set steaming crystal glasses with handles on the table in front of us. Alice flopped into a chair. Hank set his cigarette in an ashtray and picked up his toddy. He blew steam from the surface and took a cautious sip.
"So, Alice, our darling girl here was just saying we should go on a trip," he said. "Find us a plesiosaur." "Sure she was," said Alice. "She was. She has it all planned out," said Hank. "Tell him, Maddie."
"You're drunk," I said, laughing.
"That is true, I will admit," said Hank. "But I still think we should do it."
He ground the cigarette out so hard its snuffed end splayed like a spent bullet.
"We've been talking about it for years. Let's do it. I'm serious."
"No, you're not," I said. Hank once again clasped his heart.
"What's happened to you, Maddie? Don't tell me you've lost your sense of adventure. Has Violet been civilizing you in secret?"
"No, of course not. You haven't given her the chance. But we can't go now. Liners haven't run since the Athenia went down." I realized I'd made it sound like it had spontaneously sprung a leak, when in reality it had been torpedoed by a German U-boat with 1,100 civilians on board.
"Where there's a will, there's a way," said Hank, nodding sagely.
He sipped the toddy again, then peered into it accusingly.
Think I prefer whiskey after all. Back in a minute. Ellis, talk to your wife. Clearly she's picking up bad habits.
He launched himself from his chair, and for a moment looked like he might topple over. He clutched the back of Ellis's chair while he regained his balance, and finally wafted off, drifting like a butterfly. Ellis and I sat in relative silence, within a bubble created by the chatter and laughter of other people. He slid slowly down in his chair until it must have looked empty from behind. His eyes were glassy, and he turned a bit gray. My own ears buzzed from the champagne. I lifted both hands to investigate my hair and discovered the curls on one side had come undone and were clinging to my neck. Reaching further around, I realized that the diamond hair comb given to me by my mother-in-law was missing. I felt a stab of panic. It had been a gift on our wedding day, a rare moment of compassion shown me by a woman who had made no secret of not wanting me to marry her son, but was nonetheless moved to give it to me seconds before Hank walked me down the aisle.
"I think we should do it," Ella said.
"Sure," I said gaily. "We'll just hop on the next..."
"I mean it,"
he said sharply. I looked up, startled by his tone. He was grinding his jaw. I wasn't sure exactly when it had happened, but his mood had shifted. We were no longer playing a game. He looked at me in irritation.
"What? Why shouldn't we?"
"Because of the war," I said gently.
"Carpe diem and all that crap. The war is part of the adventure. God knows I'm not getting near it any other way. Neither is Hank, for that matter."
He raked a hand through his hair, leaving a swath of it standing on end. He leaned in closer and narrowed his eyes.
"You do know what they call us, don't you?" he said. "Effers."
He and Hank were the only four effers in the room. I wondered if someone had slighted him when he'd gone to find drinks. Hank took his flat-footedness in stride, as he did most things, but being given 4F status had devastated Ellis. His color blindness had gone undetected until he tried to enlist and was rejected. He'd tried a second time at a different location and was turned down again. Although it was clearly not his fault, he was right that people judged, and I knew how this chipped at him. It was relentless and unspoken, so he couldn't even defend himself. His own father, a veteran of the Great War, had treated him with undisguised revulsion since hearing the news. This injustice was made all the more painful because we lived with my in-laws, who had perversely removed any chance at escape. 2 days after the attack on Pearl Harbor, they cut Ellis's allowance by 2/3. My mother-in-law broke it to us in the drawing room before dinner, announcing with smug satisfaction that she was sure we'd be pleased to know that, until this terrible business was over, the money would be going toward war bonds. Strictly speaking, that may have been where the money was going, but it was perfectly clear that the real motive was punishing Ellis. His mother was exacting revenge because he dared to marry me, and his father, well, we weren't exactly sure. Either he didn't believe that Ellis was colorblind, or he couldn't forgive him for it. The nightmarish result was that we were forced to live under the constant scrutiny of people we'd come to think of as our captors.
"You know how hard it is," he went on, "with everyone staring at me, wondering why I'm not serving."
"They don't stare."
"Don't patronize me. You know perfectly well they do."
His outburst caused everyone to turn and look. Ellis waved an angry hand at them.
"See?"
He glanced fiercely around. To a person, they turned away, their scandalized expressions trained elsewhere. Conversations resumed, but in dampened tones. Ellis locked eyes with me.
"I know I look perfectly healthy," he continued, his voice under taut control. "My own father thinks I'm a coward, for Christ's sake. I need to prove myself. To him, to them, to me. Of all people, I thought you'd understand."
"Darling, I do understand," I said.
"But do you?"
he asked, his mouth stretching into a bitter smile. "Of course," I said. And I did. Although at that moment, I would have said anything to calm him down. He'd been drinking hard liquor since early afternoon, and I knew things could degenerate quickly. The carefully averted faces of those around us already portended a very unpleasant beginning to the new year. My mother-in-law, who had missed the party because of a migraine, would surely start receiving reports of our behavior by noon. I could only imagine how she'd react when she found out I'd lost the hair comb. I resolved to telephone the next day and throw myself on Mrs. Pugh's mercy. If the comb had come out in the snow, it was probably gone forever, but if it had fallen down the back of a sofa, it might turn up. Alice watched me closely, the fire dancing in his eyes. After a few seconds, his angry mask melted into an expression of sad relief. He leaned sideways to pat my knee and almost fell out of his chair.
"That's my girl," he said, struggling upright. "Always up for adventure. You're not like the other girls, you know. There's not an ounce of fun in them. That's why Hank won't marry Violet, of course. He's holding out for another you. Only there isn't one. I've got the one and only." "Who the whatty what now?" said Hank, appearing from nowhere and crashing back into his chair. "Over here," he barked, snapping his fingers above his head. A waiter set more drinks on the table in front of us. Hank turned back to Alice.
"Is she trying to marry me off again? I swear there's an echo in here."
"No, she's agreed. We're going to Scotland."
Hank's eyes popped open.
"Really?"
He looked at me for confirmation. I didn't think I'd agreed, per se, at least not after I realized we weren't just joking. But since I'd managed to defuse the bomb and perhaps even save the evening, I decided to play along. "Sure," I said, gesturing grandly. "Why not?" Chapter 3 The next morning, I was startled awake by the telephone ringing in the downstairs hallway. It was exactly 9 o'clock, which was the very earliest time considered civilized. I clutched the covers to my chin, paralyzed, as Pemberton, the butler, summoned my mother-in-law. I heard her determined footsteps, then her muffled voice, rising and falling in surprised waves. I was entirely wretched. My head pounded, my stomach was sour, and it was quite possible that I was still drunk. While I remembered much of the night before, there were moments I couldn't recall, like getting home. The realization that I'd passed the point of being tipsy had come over me quite suddenly. I remembered being acutely aware that it was time to call it a night, but I did not remember leaving, much less the ride home. I had no idea how many, or few, hours I'd been in bed. My ruined dress lay in a limp heap in the middle of the carpet, looking for all the world like a length of intestine. My shoes were nearby, one of them missing a heel. The white stole was flung over the edge of my polished mahogany dressing table, the fur spiked and dirty. I dropped my strand of pearls in front of my jewelry box, and both earrings, cushion-cut rubies surrounded by diamonds, were nearby, but not together. A very large champagne cork was planted squarely between them. I checked my finger for my ring, and then, with a sickening feeling of vertigo, remembered the hair comb. I burrowed my face into my pillow and pulled its edges over my ears. At noon, the housemaid knocked gently on the door, then opened it a crack. "I'm sorry, Emily. I'm not feeling up to breakfast," I said, my voice muffled by the pillow. "I've brought Alka-Seltzer and ginger snaps," she replied, which made my stomach twist again. It meant that not only had we wakened the entire house when we returned, but also that our condition had been obvious. "Put it on the table," I said, rolling to face the opposite wall. I didn't want her to see me. I'd fallen into bed without even removing my makeup, as evidenced by the streaks of mascara on my pillowcase. "Thank you, Emily." "Of course, Mrs. Hyde." She stayed longer than I expected, and when she left, I saw that she'd taken the dress, shoes, and mink with her. The telephone rang sporadically throughout the day. With each call, my mother-in-law's voice became a little more resolute, until finally it was brittle and hard. I shrank further under the covers with every conversation. At nearly 6:30, Ellis staggered into my room. He was still in his pajamas. His robe was open, its sash dragging on the floor behind him.
"Dear God, what a night," he said, scrubbing his eyes with his vest. "I'm a bit green about the gills. I could use an eye-opener. How about you?"
I suppressed a wretch.
"Are you all right?" he asked, coming closer.
His face was drawn, and there were dark semicircles beneath his eyes. I didn't even want to know how I looked. Ellis had at least made it into his pajamas. I was still in my slip. "Not really," I said. "Look what Emily brought on my breakfast tray." He glanced over and guffawed. "It's not funny," I said. "It means they're all gossiping about us in the kitchen. And I lost your mother's hair comb.
Oh, he said vaguely.
Alice, I lost the hair comb. When the gravity of this sank in, he sat on the edge of the bed, and the last of his color drained.
What am I going to do? I said, curling into a ball.
He took a deep breath and thought. After a few seconds, he slapped his thighs with resolve and said,
Well, you'll have to telephone the Pews and tell them to be on the lookout. That's all.
I was going to, but I can't.
Why not?
For one thing, I can't get near the telephone. Your mother's been on it all day. God only knows what she's heard. And anyway, I can't call Mrs. Pugh. I can't face her, not even over the telephone.
Why?
Because we were tight. We rolled around in the street.
Everyone was tight.
Yes, but not like us, I said miserably. I sat up and cradled my head in my hands. I don't even remember leaving. Do you?
Not really.
He got up and walked to my dressing table.
When did you get this? He asked, picking up the cork.
I haven't a clue, I replied. On the main floor, the telephone rang yet again, and I cowered. Ellis came back to the bed and took my hand. This time, when Pemberton fetched my mother-in-law, her footsteps were brisk, and she spoke in punctuated bursts. After a few minutes, she went silent again, and the silence was ominous, rolling through the house like waves of poisonous gas. Ellis looked at my clock.
She'll come up to dress for dinner in a few minutes. You can call then.
Come with me, I whispered, clutching his hand.
Of course, he said. Do you want one of your heart pills?
No, I'll be all right, I said.
Do you mind if I...
He let the question trail off. Of course not. Help yourself. At 10 to 7, 40 minutes before we were expected in the drawing room for cocktails, we crept downstairs, both of us in our robes, glancing nervously at each other and hiding behind corners until we ascertained that nobody was around. I felt like a child sneaking down to eavesdrop on a party for grown-ups. I telephoned Mrs. Pugh and sheepishly asked if she would please keep an eye out for my hair comb. After a slight pause, she said curtly that, yes, she would, as she had told me last night. When I hung up, I turned wordlessly to Alice, who pulled me into his arms.
"Hush, my darling," he said, pressing my head to his chest. "This too shall pass."
At 7:30, we met at the top of the stairs. I had bathed and repaired my hair as best I could in the available time. I had also put on a touch of lipstick and rouge, since my face was so devoid of color as to be nearly transparent, and dabbed some eau de toilette behind my ears. Ellis had nicked himself shaving, and there were comb marks in his wet hair.
"Ready?" he said.
"Absolutely not. You?"
"Courage, my dear," he said,
offering his arm. I curled my icy fingers in the crook of his elbow. As Ellis and I entered the drawing room, my father-in-law, Colonel Whitney Hyde, raised his face and aimed it at the grandfather clock. He was leaning against the mantel, right next to a delicate cage hanging from an elaborate floor stand. The canary within was the color of orange sorbet, a plump, smooth ovoid with a short fan of a tail, chocolate spots for eyes, and a sweet beak. He was almost too perfect to be real, and not once had he sung during my 4-year tenure in this house, even as his quarters were reduced to help him concentrate. My mother-in-law, Edith Stone Hyde, sat perched on the edge of a silk jacquard chair the color of a robin's egg, Louis XIV style. Her gray eyes latched onto us the moment we entered the room. Ellis crossed the carpet briskly and kissed her cheek.
"Happy New Year, Mother," he said. "I hope you're feeling better."
"Yes, Happy New Year," I added, stepping forward. She turned her gaze on me, and I stopped in my tracks. Her jaw was set, her eyes unblinking. Over by the mantel, the ends of the colonel's mustache twitched. The canary fluttered from its perch to the side of the cage and clung there, its fleshless toes and translucent claws wrapped around the bars. Tick-tock, went the clock. I thought my knees might go out from under me.
"Better. Am I feeling better?"
She spoke slowly, clearly, mulling the words. Her brow furrowed ever so slightly. She drummed her fingers on the arm of the chair, starting with her smallest finger and going up, twice, and then reversing the order. The rhythm was that of a horse cantering. The pause felt interminable. She looked suddenly up at Alice.
Are you referring to my migraine?
Of course, Alice said emphatically. We know how you suffer.
Do you? How kind of you. Both of you.
Tick, tock. Alice straightened his spine and his tie and went to the sideboard to pour drinks. Whiskies for the men, sherries for the ladies. He delivered his mother's, then his father's, and then brought ours over.
Tell me, how was the party? His mother said, gazing at the delicate crystal glass she held in her lap. Her voice was completely without inflection.
It was quite an event, Alice said,
too loudly, too enthusiastically.
The pews certainly do things right. An orchestra, endless champagne, never-ending trays of delicious tidbits. You'd never know there was a war going on. She asked after you, by the way. Was very sorry to hear you weren't feeling well. And the funniest thing happened at the stroke of midnight. Did you hear? People will be talking about it for years.
The colonel harrumphed and tossed back his whiskey. The canary jumped from one side of its cage to the other.
I've heard rather a lot, my mother-in-law said coldly, still staring into her glass.
Her eyes shifted deliberately to me. The blood rose to my cheeks.
So there we all were, Alice continued bravely, counting down to midnight, when all of a sudden there was a positively huge explosion. Well, even though we're a continent away from the action, you can imagine what we thought. We nearly...
Silence!
Roared the colonel, spinning to face us. His cheeks and bulbous nose had gone purple. His jowls trembled with rage. I recoiled and clutched Alice's arm. Even my mother-in-law jumped, although she regained her composure almost immediately. In our set, battles were won by sliding a dagger coolly in the back or by the quiet turn of a screw. People crumpled under the weight of an indrawn sigh or a carefully chosen phrase. Yelling was simply not done. The colonel slammed his empty glass down on the mantel.
Do you think we're fools? Do you think we haven't heard all about the real highlight of the party? What people will really be talking about for years? About your disgraceful, your depraved, your contemptible behavior?
What happened next was a blur of insults and rage. Apparently, we had done more than just get drunk and make fools of ourselves, and apparently Alice's moment of temper had not been his worst misdeed. Apparently, he had also crowed loudly about our decision to go monster hunting and show the old man up, stridently proclaiming his intentions, even as Hank was using a foot to shove him into the back of the car. The colonel and Alice closed in on each other across the enormous silk carpet, pointing fingers and trying to outshout each other. The colonel accused us of going out of our way to try to embarrass him, as well as being loathsome degenerates and generally useless members of society, and Alice argued that there was nothing he could do, and for that matter, the colonel did nothing either. What exactly did his father expect him to do? Take up a trade? My mother-in-law sat silently, serenely, with a queerly calm look on her face. Her knees and ankles were pressed together, in ladylike fashion, tilted slightly to the side. She held her unsipped sherry by the stem, her eyes widening with delight, a particularly good tilt. Then, without warning, she snapped. The colonel had just accused Alice of conveniently coming down with color blindness the moment his country needed him, the cowardice of which had caused him, his father, and a veteran, the greatest personal shame of his life, when Edith Stonehide swiveled to face her husband, bug-eyed with fury.
How dare you speak of my son like that?
To my knowledge, she had never raised her voice before in her life, and it was shocking. She continued in a strained but shrill tone that quavered with righteous indignation. Alice could no more help being colorblind than other unfortunates could help having club feet. Didn't he realize? And the colorblindness, by the way, hadn't come from her side of the family. And speaking of genetics, she blamed her. And here she actually flung out an arm and pointed at me, for Ellis's downfall. An unbalanced harlot, just like her mother.
Now see here, that's my wife you're talking about, Alice shouted.
She was no harlot, the colonel boomed.
For 2, maybe 3 seconds, there wasn't a sound in the room but the ticking of the clock and the flapping of the canary, which had been driven to outright panic. It was a haze of pale orange, banging against the sides of its cage and sending out bursts of tiny, downy feathers. Alice and I looked at each other, aghast.
"Oh, really?" my mother-in-law said calmly. "Then what, exactly, was she, dear?"
The colonel moved his mouth as though to answer, but nothing came out.
"It's all right. I always suspected. I saw the way you used to look at her," my mother-in-law continued. Her eyes burned brightly with the indignity of it all. "At least you weren't foolish enough to run off with her."
I was almost compelled to defend the colonel, to point out that everybody had looked at my mother that way. They couldn't help themselves, but knew better than to open my mouth. My mother-in-law turned suddenly to Alice.
"And you, I warned you. As embarrassing as it was, I probably could have tolerated it if you'd just wanted to carouse, to sow some wild oats. But no, despite all the other very suitable matches you could have made, you snuck off to marry..."
She paused, pursing her lips and shaking her head quickly as she decided what to call me.
"This. And I was right. The apple doesn't fall far from the tree. It's positively shameful the way the two of you and that beastly Boyd fellow carry on. I despair of the grandchildren. Although, frankly, I've nearly lost hope in that regard. Perhaps it's just as well."
She sighed and went calm again, smoothing her forehead and staring into the distance to revel in her victory. She'd successfully dressed down every other person in the room and thought it was now over. Game, set, match. She was wrong. Had she looked, she'd have noticed that Ellis was turning a brilliant shade of crimson that rose from the base of his neck, spread beneath his blonde hair, and went all the way to the tips of his ears.
"Let's talk about shame, shall we?" he said quietly, ferociously. "There's absolutely nothing that I or Maddie or anyone else could do to bring further shame upon this family. You!"
His voice rose in a crescendo until he was shouting again, pointing his glass at his father and shaking it, sloshing whiskey onto the carpet.
"Shamed all of us beyond redemption the moment you faked those pictures!"
The ensuing silence was horrifying. My mother-in-law's mouth opened into a surprised O. The small crystal glass she'd been holding slipped to the floor and shattered. Tick, tock, went the clock. This is the story as I'd heard it. In May 1933, an article appeared in a Scottish newspaper that made headlines around the world. A businessman, university-educated, the reporter was careful to point out, and his wife were motoring along the newly built A82 on the north side of Loch Ness when they spotted a whale-sized animal thrashing in otherwise perfectly calm water. Letters to the editor followed, describing similar incidents, and the journalist himself, who happened to be a water bailiff, claimed to have personally seen the Kelpie no fewer than 16 times. Another couple reported that something resembling a prehistoric monster had slithered across the road in front of their vehicle with a sheep in its mouth. A rash of other sightings followed, sparking a worldwide craze. The colonel, who had been fascinated since boyhood by cryptozoology and sea serpents in particular, came down with a full-blown case of Nessie mania. He followed the stories with increasing restlessness, clipping newspaper articles and making sketches based on the descriptions therein. He had retired from the military, and idleness did not suit him. He'd largely filled the void with big game hunting in Africa, but by then he found it unsatisfying. His trophy room was run-of-the-mill. Who didn't have a zebra skin hanging on the wall, a mounted rhinoceros head, or an elephant foot umbrella stand? Even the posed snarling lion was passé. When the first published photograph of the monster taken by a man named Hugh Gray was denounced by skeptics as being the blurred image of a swimming dog, the colonel was so incensed, he announced he was going to Scotland to prove the monster's existence personally. He prevailed upon the hospitality of his second cousin, the Laird of Craggarve, whose estate was near the shores of the loch, and in a matter of weeks had taken multiple photographs that showed the curved neck and head of a sea serpent emerging from the water. The pictures were published to widespread acclaim on both sides of the Atlantic, and the colonel's triumphant return to the United States was marked with great fanfare. Reporters flocked to the house, stories ran in all the major newspapers, and he was generally regarded as a hero. He took to wearing estate tweeds around town, which made him instantly recognizable as the celebrity he was, and joked in a faux British accent that his only regret was not being able to mount the head in his trophy room, explaining that since Scotland Yard itself had requested he not harm the beast, it would have been in bad form to do so. The height of the frenzy was when he appeared in a newsreel that played before It Happened One Night, the biggest movie of the year. Like Icarus, he flew too close to the sun. It wasn't long before the Daily Mail published an article suggesting that the size of the wake was wrong and making the scandalous accusation that the colonel had photographed a floating model. Next came allegations of photographic trickery. So-called experts claimed the photographs had been touched up and then re-photographed, citing slightly different angles and shadows, variations in the reflections. Because the colonel had processed his own film, he was unable to defend himself. The colonel swore by the veracity of his photos and expressed outrage that his honor was being called into question precisely because he'd been honorable enough to defer to the request from Scotland Yard. If he'd just gone ahead and shot the beast, and he'd brought his elephant rifle with him for that very purpose, no one would be able to deny his claims. The final nail in the coffin of public opinion was when Marmaduke Wetherall, a big game hunter who'd been on safari with the colonel several times, arrived at the lock with a cadre of reporters declaring that he was going to prove once and for all that the monster existed, and then promptly falsified monster tracks using an ashtray made from the foot of a hippo that the colonel himself had taken down in Rhodesia. Reporters and their impudent questions were no longer welcome. The colonel gave up his tweeds and his accent. The sketches and newspaper clippings, so carefully glued into Moroccan leather scrapbooks, disappeared. By the time I came into Ellis's life, the subject was taboo, and preserving the colonel's dignity paramount. Of course, what was taboo to the rest of the world was anything but to our little trio, especially when the colonel was acting particularly accusatory about Ellis's inability to serve. It was Hank who came up with the idea of us finding the monster ourselves. It was a brilliant mechanism for blowing off steam that allowed Ellis to poke merciless fun at the colonel, imagine himself triumphing where his father had failed, while simultaneously proving that he was as red-blooded as any man at the front. It was a harmless fantasy, a whimsy we trotted out and embellished regularly, usually at the end of a long night of drinking, but never within anyone's earshot. At least, not before the New Year's Eve party. Ellis swallowed loudly beside me. My mother-in-law remained frozen to her seat, her fingers and mouth still open, the crystal sherry glass in shards at her feet. The colonel's face was tinged with blue, like the skin of a ripe plum, and for a moment I thought he might be having a stroke. He lifted a quivering finger and pointed at the door.
"Get out," he said in a strange, hollow voice. "Pemberton will send your things."
Ellis shook his head in confusion.
"What do you mean? To where?"
The colonel turned his back to us, resting one elbow on the mantel, posing.
"To where?" Ellis asked with increasing desperation. "Where are we supposed to go?"
The colonel's stiff back and complete lack of response made it clear that wherever we went, it was of no concern to him. Chapter 4 Ellis directed the chauffeur to the Society Hill Hotel on Chestnut Street. On the surface, it looked fine. The facade and public areas were up to par, but our suite was faded and shabby and had only one bedroom. However, it was what we could afford on Ellis's reduced allowance. Ellis bought a bottle of whiskey from the lobby bar while the clerk was checking us in and began downing it as soon as we got upstairs. I understood his desperation. If the colonel cut his allowance completely, we'd be destitute. Regrettably, it was a very real possibility. Ellis's crime against his father was twofold, and the parts were equally grievous. He had been caught railing against the colonel behind his back, and then had accused him of fraud to his face. I didn't think the colonel was capable of forgiving either separately, but together they were exponentially worse. As we waited for our things to arrive, Ellis paced and drank, analyzing and reanalyzing what had just happened, and generally working himself into a lather. At one point, when he allowed as to how he wouldn't have lost his temper if he hadn't been driven to defend me, I thought he was unfairly trying to shift the blame to me and said so, pointing out that I hadn't uttered a word throughout the entire fiasco. He stopped and looked at me, both pained and surprised.
"My God," he said, "that's not what I meant at all. Of course it's not your fault. You did absolutely nothing. Her attack on you was